All right, well, would you all turn with me to the book of Ecclesiastes if you haven't already? We're going to be looking at chapter 8 this evening. So the book of Ecclesiastes, that name comes from one of the first words in the book, referring to the preacher, right? The words of the preacher is what this book contains. And the word in Hebrew for the preacher is Koheleth, which simply means the one who addresses the assembly. And the one who addresses the assembly, typically when you translate that to the Greek for the word assembly, you get the word ekklesia, right? That's where we get assembly or church. And so Ecclesiastes is that Greek version of the term for Koheleth, the preacher. And so these are the words of the preacher to the assembly of God's people. And what we see in chapter 1 is that this is the son of David and the king of Israel. So most assume that the preacher here speaking is Solomon, King Solomon. And what we have seen Solomon do within this book is he has been asking the question, what is the meaning of life? Where can we find purpose under the sun? Is there anything, after looking at all of the world and all of that life has to offer, is there anything that will bring true satisfaction and fulfillment? And so we've seen him go on multiple different pursuits or quests, seeking fulfillment, seeking satisfaction, trying to make sense of this world and find meaning and purpose. And so he went on quests for pleasure. He went on pursuits for wisdom and for all of these different pursuits. And after he comes to the end of all of these different quests, he recognizes that none of them are meeting that standard or fulfilling him or satisfying him completely. And so what he refers to them as is vanity or hevel in the Hebrew, which basically is saying all of these things are like smoke or vapor. They are here for a moment and then they're gone the next. You can't really hold on to them. There's no lasting satisfaction, no lasting fulfillment within these things. And so he's been working through this book to really, I think, lead us to the fear of the Lord, which is something that he's continuously been bringing up, and how ultimately when we see that none of these things will really give us satisfaction, really give us fulfillment, the one thing that will give us that fulfillment, the thing that we're seeking truly, is to fear God, to be in a reverential relationship with God himself. And so what we saw last time in chapter 7 was where Solomon kind of took a little bit of a break from some of these different pursuits that he's been on, and he kind of just wanted to offer some practical wisdom, some wisdom for life. And what he kind of did was explain that usually when people look at the world and they think about all of the vanity, all of the hevel there is, right, when we see the injustices, when we see oppression going on, really there's two options on the table that people take in life. And some will take the route of escapism, which basically what they do is they try to dull their senses, they try to numb themselves and kind of just avoid conflict, kind of forget about the problems. And so they party loud, they laugh loud, they do all of these different things to kind of distract themselves in life before death comes. But then there's the other route, which Solomon advises, which is, is wisdom. And what he chooses to show is how wisdom is the better option, because what wisdom does is it actually roots us in reality. And what it does is it allows us to really deal with seasons of life as they come, and it will actually make us the better for it. And in fact, it'll actually allow us to cultivate true, real relationships where we can be honest with one another. We can challenge and correct and encourage one another in righteousness and in holiness. And so he basically shares with us the practical benefits of wisdom. But then after he gives a long list of these benefits that come with wisdom and how he encourages us to pursue that path, he then shows that, remember, wisdom is not God itself, right? And also wisdom won't make us God. So he shares not only benefits of wisdom, but also the limitations of wisdom, and shows how ultimately we won't still have all of the answers. There will still be things we can't control, things that we won't be able to overcome in this world just simply by our own wisdom. And so that's kind of where we stopped last time in chapter 7. And so with chapter 8, he's going to kind of continue this thought process of sharing some wisdom with us and once again appreciating the value of wisdom, and then showing how we can utilize and relate wisdom to the governing authorities, so those who are over us in power structures or in the government. And he's going to share with us on how that works. And then he's going to compare and contrast those who are wise with those who are wicked, those who basically choose not to take the wise path. And so that's what we'll be looking at this evening. We'll be looking at, once again, the value of wisdom, how it relates to our governing authorities, and then ultimately the difference between those who are wise with those who are wicked. So let us read chapter 8 this evening. It says, "Who is like a man, or who is like a wise man, and who knows the interpretation of a thing? A man's wisdom makes his face shine, and the sternness of his face is changed. I say, keep the king's commandment for the sake of your oath to God. Do not be hasty to go from his presence. Do not take your stand for an evil thing, for he does whatever pleases him. Where the word of a king is, there is power. And who may say to him, 'What are you doing?' He who keeps his command will experience nothing harmful. And a wise man's heart discerns both time and judgment. Because for every matter there is a time and judgment. Though the misery of man increases greatly, for he does not know what will happen. So who can tell him when it will occur? No one has power over the spirit to retain the spirit. And no one has power in the day of death. There is no release from that war. And wickedness will not deliver those who are given to it. All this I have seen and applied my heart to every work that is done under the sun. There is a time in which one man rules over another to his own hurt. Then I saw the wicked buried, who had come and gone from the place of holiness, and they were forgotten in the city where they had so done. This also is vanity. Because the sentence against an evil work is not executed speedily, therefore the heart of the sons of men is fully set in them to do evil. Though a sinner does evil 100 times, and his days are prolonged, yet I surely know that it will be well with those who fear God, who fear before him. But it will not be well with the wicked, nor will he prolong his days, which are as a shadow, because he does not fear before God. There is a vanity which occurs on earth, that there are just men to whom it happens according to the work of the wicked. Again, there are wicked men to whom it happens according to the work of the righteous. I said that this also is vanity. So I commended enjoyment, because a man has nothing better under the sun than to eat, drink, and be merry. For this will remain with him in his labor all the days of his life, which God gives him under the sun. When I applied my heart to know wisdom and to see the busyness that is done on earth, even though one sees no sleep day or night, then I saw all the work of God, that a man cannot find out the work that is done under the sun. For though a man labors to discover it, yet he will not find it. Moreover, though a wise man attempt to know it, he will not be able to find it." So in the very beginning, we see in verse 1 this reminder, as we've seen in some other books or some other chapters, the value of wisdom. And there's really kind of almost three thoughts here in which how he once again explains how good wisdom is to apply to our lives. And the first thing that he does is he asks the question in verse 1. He says, "Who is like a wise man?" Now, once again, if you remember, the previous chapter was just describing all of these benefits of wisdom and how you apply them. And when we apply wisdom, it explains how people will be open to instruction. They'll be less angry. They won't be dwelling on the past. And there's a long list of things that the wise do as opposed to what the foolish do. And so I think what he's doing here, after he's given this list and compared the limitations with the benefits, he then asks the question, who is like a wise man? And I think what he's kind of getting at here is that wisdom is kind of rare and unique. We see, I think, in the beauty of wisdom, we also see the uniqueness of wisdom. In fact, most people don't take this path that he has been offering, right? He said that there's a lot of people that like the escapist path, right? They're the ones that they like to just try to forget about the difficult seasons of life. They don't like to talk about death or the hard conversations. They're not really focused on spiritual building, right? They're more so just like, let's just get by and try to enjoy things and forget about the real issues in this life. And so I think what this is showing us is that if you choose to take the wise path, you'll be taking the path less traveled. You'll be taking a more narrow path than others are taking. But more than it being rare and unique, we also see here that in the next statement or the next question, it says, "And who knows the interpretation of a thing?" So I think what it's showing us is that wisdom, right? The question is, who is like a wise man. So it's rare, it's unique. But then he's saying, and for those who choose this path, who cultivate wisdom, it also will allow you to truly understand the complexities of life, because there are going to be these questions, right, of a thing, and who can interpret it, who can understand it. And what he's, I think, saying is that those who choose the path of wisdom will be able to actually come up with some of these answers. They actually will be able to explain some of the complexities of life. They can give you some answers to some difficult questions. Now, as we'll see in this chapter, that's not going to be able to answer every question, but those who are wise will be able to answer some different things, the different questions that are happening. But then the final thing in verse 1 that we see is, not only is it rare and unique, not only will it allow you to understand and interpret the complexities of life, but then we see that it's describing that a man's wisdom makes his face shine, and the sternness of his face is changed. So it's describing actually the countenance of an individual, or the presence, right? The appearance of an individual who actually walks in wisdom. And it says that when you walk in wisdom, it actually has kind of a transformative power to your life. It actually will manifest in the way that it actually makes you look different than other people. And maybe you've kind of seen this in maybe a different category, where you've ever heard someone say, you know, if you work out and stay in shape, people typically think that you're more competent, right? If you're someone that stays in shape and works out, they're like, oh, this person probably knows what they're doing. Or if you see someone where they make eye contact, and, you know, they keep their shoulders back, or especially for men, like, you know, and you have a firm handshake, it gives kind of a presentation for who you are, that you are someone that is to be taken, you know, seriously, that you respect. Well, I think what this is saying is that, like those things, when you pursue wisdom, it's also going to have a benefit to how people perceive you, and what they're going to see is that you're actually going to be shining. And it's going to, not only is it going to say that you're going to be shining, but the sternness of your face is going to be changed. It's going to be almost like softened, in a sense. So it'll be like as if people will actually be wanting to approach you. You'll be a more approachable person. And I think in one sense, that's kind of what we would like. We want to be someone that people not only would respect and think that they are competent, but also someone that would be approachable, right? Someone that you would want to draw near to. So we see these different benefits of wisdom, the value of wisdom here. And I think it's interesting that it uses this phrase for shining, right? And I'm reminded of Numbers 6:25, and I'm sure many of you are familiar with this, where it says, "The Lord makes his face shine upon you and be gracious to you." So this is obviously a blessing given. And one of the ways that it's describing God's blessing to his people is his face shining upon his people, right? So God will actually, one of the ways he'll bless us is by letting his face shine on us. So it's actually a good manifestation of what God is doing. He's giving us something of his character that we are able to perceive and to experience. But what's so cool about this is in 1 Corinthians chapter 1, verse 30, we see that the description of Jesus is actually, he's described in 1 Corinthians 1:30 as the wisdom of God. So now if what we're saying here in this, in 8:1, if we're saying that whenever you have wisdom, right, it'll make your face shine, and we say that God shines his face upon his people, and that's a form of blessing, and then we see that Jesus himself is the wisdom of God. So what we're saying now is that if you actually are pursuing God, you start to look more like God. Kind of like if you remember Moses, right? Moses spent time with the Lord. He was walking with the Lord. And then all of a sudden he had his face was shining or glowing, right? And he actually had to like put a veil on, right? Because he had been with God. I think it's kind of explaining it's like that. It's when we actually are walking in wisdom, when we are pursuing godly wisdom, right? Because we know that the fear of the Lord is the beginning of true wisdom. I think what we're seeing is that when you spend time with God, you actually start to look like God. You start to have that shining radiance of his glory. And one other thing I want to read on this, and I think this is kind of what this is getting at in 2 Corinthians 3:18, it says, "But we all, with unveiled face, beholding as in a mirror the glory of the Lord, are being transformed into the same image from glory to glory, just as by the Spirit of the Lord." So it's actually saying that we, in a relationship with Christ, we actually start to be transformed into the same image of Christ, and we actually start to radiate his glory. We actually shine his glory. So I think that in one sense, we see this encouragement for not only pursuing God, but pursuing Him and His wisdom, because Christ is the, obviously, the ultimate form of His wisdom. And we see that whenever you pursue these things, that it actually will have a lasting effect on the way that you present yourself to others. And so I think it's important that we think about this as then we are moving into verses 2 to 9, because I think what we see is that when you have the face of wisdom, it's going to have a positive impact on the way that you relate to others. And specifically in verses 2 to 9, it's going to show how we relate to our governing authorities, right? So when we pursue wisdom, when we pursue Christ, right, the personification of wisdom or the incarnation of wisdom, we're actually going to see that it will manifest in us shining in this world, living a godly life, showing God's glory, and it will also show to the king, as it's going to mention here, or to our authorities, our governing officials, things like that. So if you look in verses 2 to 4, we see then how he explains, now that we are called to pursue, we see the benefit of wisdom. This is how we see wisdom working out with our governing authorities. It says, "I say, keep the king's commandment for the sake of your oath to God. Do not be hasty to go from his presence. Do not take your stand for an evil thing, for he does whatever pleases him. For where the word of a king is, there is power, and who may say to him, what are you doing?" So in verses 2 to 4, what we're seeing here is it gives this command by Solomon, or the preacher. It says, keep the king's commandment. So he's calling those who are listening, right, those who are reading his words here, to, when you see the king and he gives a decree, he gives a law, he's commanding you to do something, he's saying, keep that, obey it, right? To submit to your governing authorities and listen to them. And then in verse 3, and he's saying, and don't be hasty to go against them, right? So basically, practice or exercise caution and not being someone that will flee from his presence or flee from a decree that he is maybe making here. And then he kind of explains that because ultimately the king has a lot of power. And if you decide to go against the king, there can be some serious consequences, right? We obviously know what that looks like in our own world, right? If you break the law, then we know bad things can happen. Essentially what he's saying there, but with a king in Solomon's day, they have a lot more power than even like our police force or a governor or a mayor or even the president, right? Because a king has like this unilateral power, and basically no one can really ultimately question the king, right? Obviously we could spiritually question the king, but that's what it's saying. It's like who can ask the question, what are you doing, right? Because he's the king, right? He's going to be able to make these decrees. So he's kind of giving this this command, in a sense, to keep the king's commands. And I think you see this similarly in Proverbs 24:21, where it says, "My son, fear the Lord and the king. Do not associate with those given to change." So once again, it's saying that we need to give a reverence to not only God himself, but also we give reverence to the governing authorities. We give a respect to them, right? So we are to do both of these things, and we shouldn't be eager to jump with the groups or the masses that are rebellious in spirit or rebellious in nature, that always are wanting to oppose the system, right? Or they want to go against those who are higher up because they disagree with them on certain things like that. And this isn't just an Old Testament principle. We actually will see that in the New Testament, that every Christian is also called to do this. Christians are called to be law-abiding citizens. We are actually supposed to be model citizens, the best citizens in society, right? So sometimes I've heard Christians sadly say this, and they're like, well, I know a lot of people don't do this, or they don't listen to this law, or they don't hear this, so I'm not going to do it either. But the thing is, that should never be the Christian mentality of, oh, the masses or a lot of people are doing it, are not doing it, so I'm going to do the same thing. No, the Christians are saying, we want to follow the law as best as possible. We want to be the standard. We want to be the example to the people in our communities. And we see this, I think, in Luke 20:25, where it says, where Jesus said, "Render therefore to Caesar the things that are Caesar's, and to God the things that are God's." Now, if you know the context of what's going on there, they're trying to trap Jesus about paying their taxes, right? Because if you know, Roman oppression was, the taxation was very, very high, and it was causing a lot of people to suffer and experience the difficulty in their communities. And so what they're thinking is, oh, we're going to get Jesus basically to basically either say, don't pay your taxes and get him in trouble with Rome, or maybe he's going to say, don't pay, or say don't pay your taxes, get in trouble with Rome, or pay your taxes and then the people won't like him, right? So they're trying to get him in a trap, and what he does basically is he says that there are certain things that the government, or that Caesar, right, that would be the emperor, right, basically if they decree something, you're supposed to honor, pay your taxes. He's like, but ultimately there are certain other things that are God's, and you're supposed to give those things to God. So basically he's saying respect your authority. He's actually giving that that teaching that we see kind of similar with Solomon. But we also see it with the Apostle Paul in Romans 13:1. And I know we went through this Romans series not that long ago, so I'm sure many of you are familiar with this passage as well. It says, let every soul, so that would be every soul, not just Christians, be subject to the governing authorities. For there is no authority except from God, and the authorities that exist are appointed by God. So now it's saying that every soul is to be subject, is to obey the governing authorities, and we're supposed to give them fear or reverence, and we're supposed to pay our taxes, even if it's a very oppressive government that has very high taxation. We're supposed to do all of these things because ultimately, every government is established, every king is put on the throne by the permissive will of God. God is ordaining and allowing these individuals to be in power, so we are then called to submit and to subject ourselves to these governing authorities. And once again, so he's saying that this is the wise thing to do. He's describing wise activity in relation to the authority. And I think ultimately what it's saying here is because it says that we've made an oath to God in this text. It says in verse 2, because we've made an oath to God. And I think what this is actually kind of explaining is that when we submit to our earthly authorities, right, whenever we actually willingly obey and we try to get along and be the model citizen, what we're actually doing is we are honoring the lordship of Jesus Christ and the kingdom of heaven. What we're really showing is that we are citizens of heaven. Whenever you live a good moral life, when you seek to do well to your neighbor and to listen to your authorities, you're actually showing what the kingdom of heaven is like. You're showing that we have a heart that is of service and of submission and love and respect for our fellow man. And so I think we see that this is a part of what we're seeing here in this call. Now, of course, as we're seeing this, he's specifically talking about the practical day-to-day, what it should look like. Now, that doesn't mean that there are not exceptions to this rule. And I'm sure many of you probably, when you hear that, you immediately are thinking about the exception, but it's sometimes when we teach the exceptions, we also need to remind ourselves of the strong call throughout Scripture that we do need to hear the be subject part, you know, the submit part. But clearly we know that there are certain cases where good faith Christians cannot submit, right? We cannot obey, right? There are certain times where we have to resist. Now, think about Daniel, which I actually think Daniel is a great example of someone who's was pursuing wisdom and his face was shining. And in fact, many of the governing authorities really liked him because of the way he presented himself and appeared to others, right? They saw that there was a wisdom to him, a good man, a holy man. But we also see that there was a time where there was a decree where you could not pray. He wasn't allowed to pray to his God, but he didn't obey to that, did he? He actually resisted, and obviously we know that's what happens. He gets thrown into the lion's den. We know that with the three friends, that they also were called to bow to the statue, right? And they also resist. They say, we won't bow or worship anybody but our one true God. But in the New Testament, we see this very clearly in Acts 5:29. It says, but Peter and the other apostles answered and said, we ought to obey God rather than men. And that's whenever they are commanding them, don't preach the name of Jesus, right? Don't share the gospel. And so I think what we see then is that there's a clear biblical precedent for not only submitting to our governing authorities, but also we are called to adamantly resist and oppose our governing authorities in moments where they are calling us to either resist what God has already commanded us, or if we are to, if they're commanding us to do something that God has told us not to do. So we have to see that there are certain cases where God is always over our government. God is always our ultimate authority in these things. And so we see that there's definitely clear limitations to this command that we're seeing here. But in verses 5 to 6, we see, I think, kind of an explanation of how we weigh this out and we balance this. Because it says, he who keeps his command will experience nothing harmful. So that's saying that's the benefit of the matter. If you listen and obey your governing authorities, that there won't be harm coming to you. But then what it says, in a wise man's heart discerns both time and judgment. because for every matter there is a time and judgment. And so what I think what he's showing us here is that, so the general rule is to submit, to keep the king's commands, right? Generally speaking, that's how we should live our day-to-day lives. Obviously, we know that there are clear biblical limitations for certain commands that are ungodly, that are wicked. We aren't called to obey those, right? We don't follow sin. We follow the Lord. But in certain cases where it is more difficult to understand, what we are called to do here, I think, is exercise wisdom and caution. And we do this by discerning the proper time and procedures. So there will be certain times and certain procedures, certain methods that we will use to discern whether or not what we're doing is biblical or is right. So one example I think about is like the pandemic, right? That's where you had a lot of Christians that started kind of, butting heads a little bit, right? They were not always agreeing on all of the matters of should we assemble at this time? How should we assemble? How should we worship, right? And I think what this is showing us here is that whenever you find yourself in these gray moments, it's so important to seek after wisdom. It's also important that you caution yourself and don't just immediately make a quick decision and say, well, we're going to do this. And you don't really pray about it. You don't seek counsel about it. And I think that's one thing I personally learned through like the pandemic season was that you don't always have to have the answer right away. Sometimes like when you're in ministry and especially if you're teaching or if you're trying to make these big decisions, sometimes you feel like pressed, like you have to make a decision or take a stance. And sometimes I think what we're seeing here is that it's not always the proper time to just give an opinion or to speak or to stand up for something, especially on things like that that's so new and you're not really sure exactly how to respond to a situation like that. I think what he's showing us here is that, once again, that there's wisdom shows that there's this principle. There's obviously exceptions to the principle, and throughout as we're trying to discern which things we do, we always give wisdom and caution to them, and we look for the appropriate time, and God, I think, giving us wisdom will allow us to see when it's appropriate or not appropriate to do certain things. And then finally in 7 to 9, which this is kind of the end of this second section, we see kind of just this warning passage for those who basically choose not to do what he just recommended with wisdom, right? So if you decide not to pursue wisdom, if you aren't going to keep the king's command, if you're not going to be cautious with going with the mob or going with a group that's seeking to rebel, what it's basically explaining is that there's going to be these things that are going to happen that you ultimately can't control. And it's kind of explaining how, like, just as no man can postpone their death, and it kind of explains it as like the spirit being taken from you, or the day of your death, it says, or you won't be able to be released from the battle or the war. It's saying so too, whenever you choose wickedness, you're not going to be able to escape the consequences of your wickedness. So basically, if you say, okay, I'm going to go against the king, well, if you pursue that, just like you're not going to be able to control the day of your death or control when your spirit leaves your body, so too you're not going to be able to control the consequences of your choices. So basically he's saying that be wise and be cautious and think about your actions before you go against your governing authorities. So he's basically saying it's really important that you think about what you do before you act. So I kind of see this being as a general warning for us when we're dealing with individuals, because he knows that there's many kings and leaders that are corrupt, right? We've already seen in previous chapters how he says even in the highest authorities that people were unjust and they were oppressing the people that were poorer than them. So he says that even though I know all of this, here is the practical wisdom for this matter, how you are to handle and think about these things. Because there's going to be times where even though we disagree with the governing authorities, even though we don't like what they're doing, but they're not actually causing us to sin and they're not making us dishonor God, a lot of those times we just have to be wise and be patient and trust the Lord. And I think you see many of God's people doing that throughout the Word of God, where we see them basically being patient and trusting the Lord, and they're not trying to raise up an army to attack the government, right? They're just trusting the Lord in those moments. So now we move to the final section in verses 10 to 17. And in this section, what I think we see then is that after it's explaining the practical benefits of wisdom relating to not only one another, but also to governing authorities, he's going to explain that there are these groups, right, that are the wicked, right, and that they're not going to choose the path of wisdom. And what he's going to explain as he, especially in verse 10, explains how he sees an individual who was wicked and they were buried, right? So they got an honorable burial in the town that they were wicked in. And this is an individual that had been able to go to the holy place back and forth, which was probably the temple. So this is someone that basically was living in the city, was living a wicked life, basically got to go in and out of the temple all the time with no repercussions, and then got an honorable burial, and then he died, right? And so what he's going to let that be is a springboard experience for him to explain death and how wisdom plays into that, and basically asking the question of, well, is God going to work this out? Like, why is it that we see some good things happening to the wicked and bad things happening to the wise, right? You would think that it'd be the opposite of that. So what's going on here? And I think the promise that we're going to see in this section is that those who fear God will do well. Those who fear God will do well in the end. And I want to just point to you this little fact that you'll notice is the preacher in this section, he transitions from what he saw to what he knew. If you'll notice at the very beginning of verse 10, it'll say what he saw, but then as we move down, it's going to explain what he knows to be true. So not just what he just sees, and there's going to be times where we see bad things happening, right? We see the wicked flourishing, and we see the righteous suffering, and there's times that we're going to see that, but we need to be reminded of what Solomon is teaching us and what he knows here. And you're going to see that, I think, in verse 12, you'll see what he actually knows. But if we just will read verses 10 to 11 here, it says, "Then I saw the wicked buried, who had come and gone from the place of holiness, and they were forgotten in the city where they had so done. This also is vanity, because the sentence against an evil work is not executed speedily. Therefore, the heart of the sons of men is fully set in them to do evil." So as I said, what this is describing is how the wicked seem to go unpunished in this world. There's this man who's been wicked, and he basically didn't get punished. He just got to live his life, and then he died, and then he got, like I said, this honorable burial, and then people basically forgot about it. They forgot about him, they forgot about the wickedness that occurred, and he's basically saying that this is vanity. And the problem with this is that whenever we see people that don't get punished when they should, right? They don't get their justice if they're living a wicked life. What it actually does, if you see in verse 11, it actually will encourage other people to evil, right? If you see people doing evil and they get away with it and then they get buried and everything else seems to turn out the same as anybody else, why wouldn't you choose the evil path, right? Because sometimes, a lot of times, it's the easier path. I'm sure many of you probably know that, right? If you see that everyone's flying down the highway, right, they're all going way above the speed limit, you're like, well, I can probably go way above the speed limit too, and I'll just go a little bit less than they are, because then they're going to get caught or stopped and not me, right? Because it's easy, it's a slippery slope when you see people breaking the law or testing the limits, then it's easier for other people to do it. I know that personally, whenever I did sports back in the day, I know that there were so many times, like, we would, you know, jog around the court or the football field, and you're supposed to not cut the corners, right? You've probably heard that expression, cutting corners. That's where it comes from. It's like, literally, there, you'll see it whenever you get one of those older, you know, upperclassmen, they cut a couple corners. And then by the end, after we've done multiple laps, you start to see where people are literally, they're like not even near the edge of the field anymore. They are literally cutting through. I know certain individuals that are friends and family of mine that literally would like be cutting the entire end zone off. So literally, there are a lot of times where you see it happen a little bit, and then it starts becoming bigger and bigger. And I think that's what he's saying here, is that if you allow all of this to go on, people get encouraged to do evil and wickedness. And so Solomon's saying, this is a problem, and this is something that the righteous, that those who are pursuing wisdom are having to deal with here. So in verses 12 to 14, what he then does is he explains that though it may look like they're getting, they're getting an unfair advantage because they're disobeying and they're rebelling and doing these evil things, and it seems like there's no consequences, he does give an encouragement to explain that it will be well for those who fear God. So let us read verses 12 to 14. It says, "Though a sinner does evil 100 times, and his days are prolonged, yet I surely know," so this is where he changes from what he saw to, "but I surely know that it will be well for those who fear God, who fear before Him. But it will not be well with the wicked, nor will he prolong his days, which are as a shadow, because he does not fear before God. There is a vanity which occurs on earth, that there are just men to whom it happens according to the work of the wicked. Again, there are wicked men who it happens according to the work of the righteous. I said that this also is vanity. So once again, he's explaining that he knows, he has confidence in the fact that those who trust and fear the Lord, that it will be well, that God will work things out for their good. And it's interesting that the way that it describes it, right? It describes there's this one individual that has sinned and done evil 100 times and their days have been prolonged, right? So this is a great example of someone that's like, you know, how can they do all of this sin and all of this wickedness and then their days are extended, right? This is the struggle that he's dealing with. And I think what this is actually describing is the desperate attempt of those who are wicked or the lost. That's all that they have, if you think about it, that to prolong their life. Because they know whenever they hit death, that's the end for them. You know, so they will sin, and as long as they're getting away with it, they're going to keep doing it and doing it. And they know that ultimately, after they prolong their days as long as they can, it's the end. And I think sometimes we, as, once again, the escapists, what they do is they try to forget the end part. So they just, you know, they take advantage of people and try to benefit and rise up to power as much as they can. But then they get to the end, and then a lot of times whenever that happens, they try to not think about it or even talk about it very much. And so sometimes what we see in our own culture, and you've probably seen this even posted or you've heard people say this before, where after you have a wicked person that has done what we see described here, after they die, you know what many of them say? You know, well, they're in a better place, right? But the thing is, what we're seeing here is not everyone goes to heaven. See, that's the false thing. The false teaching of the world is that they're in a better place. The true biblical teaching is, no, they're not in heaven. Another one is, well, rest in peace. The biblical truth is there are millions, billions, right, that are not living or resting in peace. Right? And then the other one that I hate theologically is when they say, and well, having gained another angel, you don't become an angel, right? So we see that there's this ongoing process of the wicked, that they sin and then they don't think about death, and then whenever death comes, they try to make up these false teachings of what maybe their life will be like. But what he's ultimately saying is, no, that's not the case. In Matthew 8:12, Jesus said, it says, but the sons of the kingdom will be cast out into outer darkness. There will be weeping and gnashing of teeth. So this is the promise that Jesus gives for those individuals. And so what we see, as it says here, it will not be well for the wicked. That's the ending result. It's hell is the ending result for those who choose this path. So no matter how long you might seem on the earth, when it comes to comparing to eternity, it's not going to be worth it. But then, as I said, he switches and he says, but it will be well for those who fear God. So though we might have a difficult way of it on this side of eternity, we see that ultimately it's going to be worth it in the end. We know that through the gospel message, right, that the righteous are redeemed and we have the hope of resurrection, right? So we actually have this eternal hope for believers. And I think what it means here to live a God-fearing life, it's referring to living in a constant awareness of His presence. It says actually that you fear before Him or fear God before Him. And I think this is showing us that when we are in a relationship with God, when we fear the Lord, it's reminding us every single day as we see these things, we can continue to remind us of the truth. That God is with us, He's shining upon us, and that we ultimately are looking to glory, to the final day. And so we can actually live a life and not be caught up with all of the injustice and think, well, maybe I should just go with them, because, like I said, a lot of people will be encouraged to cut the corners. But what he's saying here is that whenever you fear the Lord, you'll be reminded of His presence daily, and you'll actually be able to have a hope and recognize, and you'll be able to say what we sang earlier, which it is well. In every season of life, every difficult time, you'll be able to say, it is well with your soul. And so in verse 15, what he then does is he encourages us with what he said multiple times, where he says, so enjoy life. Enjoy the time that you have been given. Every single day, God has given you life, and He actually wants you to enjoy it, to find the simplicity of life and enjoy these things, and don't brood over the evil that happens. Doesn't mean we don't, you know, fight against or combat it or seek to make things more right in the world, but ultimately try to find some joy in life and say, it is well with my soul, and I know that God will ultimately set all things right. And then the final thing that we see in verses 16 to 17, it once again gives us this quick reminder of the limitations of wisdom again, to explain that even with this wisdom that we've acquired, right, there's these benefits we've seen. It'll help us with our governing authorities. It'll also help us fear the Lord. But there will still be things that we will not be able to understand or comprehend on this side of eternity. And so God does not expect us to know the unknowable. There will be things that we just simply will not know. And so in these moments, we're once again called to trust the Lord. That's what fear of the Lord once again is. It's trust and rely on God and His plan. When we see these wicked things happening, when we see the injustice, trust in God and His wisdom, and we know that ultimately, once again, it will be well.